Rob Wolf, Andy D is back with episode 40, the big one, the Paleolithic Solution.
The middle age spread. We're getting fat and old.
Are you feeling old right now?
Not too bad. I'm feeling pretty good right now.
All right. I like it. I like it. Yeah. Anything exciting going on that we should talk about? Keystone, a year older maybe.
Keystone's good. the book is almost ready to go to the printers. Once it goes to the printers, then actually by the time this thing posts, it will probably be at the printers, and it's a 2-week turnaround. So we're super close on having hard copies of the book.
So when you say 2-week turnaround and it's gone to the printers, does that mean it's going out? It's not going out to the pre-order people yet, right? Isn't that like a month away, or what's kind of the timeline?
Once it hits the printer, then it's 2 weeks, 10 to 14 days from there, and then okay. It will go to the Victory Belt Distribution Center. From the Victory Belt Distribution Center, then all of our advanced copy readers, which we have a number of people that are going to review the book ahead of time, they will receive their copies, and then the folks who pre-ordered, then, you know, we're getting close to September as it is. Like, by the time all that's done, September 10th is rolling around here really soon, and then the week of September 10th, it'll be Barnes & Noble, Borders, all that sort of jive, and then obviously the folks that are ordering off of Amazon, they'll receive theirs. So,
cool. Nice.
Getting close.
You're almost worldwide, Rob Wolf.
Where will we go then?
If I see your book in the airport, a little newsstand, we'll know you've made it.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Or that there's just really nothing good to read. Well, I don't know. This schlep is here, so we'll sell it in the airport.
It's got a nice cover anyway, so yeah. You know, it's eye candy. All right, good. Well, we got a good group of questions. And I think we just get started, Rob, because I feel like last episode we rambled for like 15 or 20 minutes, and I don't know how that went over.
We had a little catching up last time.
That's true. And hopefully this week, you know, I'm a little more on my game since, you know, this is another episode we're recording. 2 weeks off, man, I get rusty, you know.
It's a highly technical endeavor that you're doing there. It's a tight wire walking and landing a Boeing jet on an aircraft carrier, similar endeavors, so...
Wow, yes, I was going to make a cross a joke. I'm going to leave it alone right now, Rob. Leave it alone.
I opened it right up for that. Nice.
Anyway, first we got a question from Michelle. Rob, forgive me if I've missed it, but so far I haven't come across anything on paleo eating and diverticulitis. My mother, 63 years old, has a terrible recurring case. The lack of dietary guidance she receives around her outbreaks is absolutely astounding to me. And the amount of suffering she endures is pitiful to watch. So far, I've not developed diverticulitis myself, but experienced relief from lots of milder GI problems when I went paleo. Is there any research or even anecdotal evidence on paleo plus diverticulitis you can share with me?
Yeah, I mean, one of the quickest things that you can look for is just diverticulitis gluten and look at the linkage there. We have like Crohn's disease, irritable bowel syndrome, diverticulitis, colitis. All of these things have similar underpinnings. Like grains, legumes, dairy play a significant role in the inflammation, omega-3, omega-6 imbalance, usually some insulin dysregulation. And it's kind of this perfect storm of problems. If you poke around on my website, if you just Google diverticulitis, then you will find commenters that have had diverticulitis that have put the condition into remission by doing the whole gluten-free, dairy-free paleo. The challenge, the problem for our parents, you know, 60, 70-year-old parents, is that they, you know, the whole old dog, new tricks kind of gig. It's hard to get them to adopt anything different. But for Michelle, eating this way, I would, you know, you can pretty much take it to the bank that you're not going to develop diverticulitis out of an outgrowth of eating paleo. Like the likelihood is really, really low. You're definitely hedging your bets in a very favorable direction.
Yep. All right. Man, this has all happened before, Rob.
And it will all happen again.
And Rob, by the way, totally related and unrelated, you need to go see Inception. That's what was on my mind.
That's what I've heard. I've heard that's pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was epic. A couple people I went with either loved it or hated it. I loved it. Christopher Nolan is a genius, so I think you should check it out. Drag Nikki. It may stress her out, but you know, it's entertainment. Just tell her.
Perfect. Okay. I'll take her tonight since I'm leaving tomorrow, and then she can just be stressed while I'm gone. So.
There you go.
Leave her alone to deal with her own like post-traumatic stress.
Next, we got a question from Matt. Rob, I've heard you briefly talk about the effects of birth control on the ability to lean out. Actually, I think you have just made some references about it, but I did not gather enough information for a clear decision on it. I have a 23-year-old client, strict paleo, limited to no fruit, some post-training yam, whey slop, some caloric restriction IF. She follows a Max Effort Black Box program and is sleeping 7 or 8 hours most days per week. There are some days that she has poor sleep. It's probably a once-a-week thing. In my opinion, minus the one day where her sleep might be a little sloppy, she should be leaning out on this diet/program. However, she is on birth control. Could this be the reason she is not leaning out? How do you look, feel, perform department, she feels good, she's getting stronger, and her Metcon is good. I would appreciate any advice on this topic. Sorry for any spelling errors. I typed this on my phone.
Nice. there's just no doubt about it. Like, birth control absolutely stymies fat loss. It's just true. But then that said, over the last 6 months, at any given point, we've had between like 6 and 12 women in our gym. We run anywhere from like a 5 to 15% pregnancy rate down there, like percentage of our clientele. So if you're eating this way, you know, kind of low carbish paleo training, CrossFit-esque Max Effort Black Box, and you're female, your likelihood of getting pregnant is really, really high. So you have to do that cost-benefit analysis. Is it worthwhile to you to not be as lean as you want while not getting pregnant? And that's really what it boils down to. But it absolutely, you can tinker with it. Estrogen, progesterone approaches, they all tend to have chicks run anywhere from like 5 to 10 pounds heavier than what they would without them.
Yep. I can't believe you didn't use your cock blocks comment, Rob. You're cleaning up your act.
I'm trying to diversify things. I don't want to become too predictable. So.
Well, if you say holy cat, someone out there is going to have to drink. So.
People have been teasing me on the Facebook page about the holy cat. So.
Well, it is a Rob Wolfism. So.
That's frightening.
Next, we got a question from Preston. Hey, Rob, another good podcast. Do you or Matt have any papers on moderate fructose uptake, i.e. not a fructose-rich diet in isocaloric conditions, upregulating liver glucose uptake, as you mentioned? This would be news to me and sounds really interesting. I did several PubMed searches and found no papers with this kind of conclusion. All the studies on fructose affecting liver glycogen and insulin sensitivity that I found seem to be in rats fed a fructose-rich diet, even if it is isocaloric. But the fructose-rich diet always throws off the macronutrient ratio in comparison to the control group and ends up resulting in a much higher percentage of carbohydrates in the diet. Therefore, the sugar load of the entire diet is skewed and the results cannot be strictly tied to fructose. It's certainly easy to overeat fruit, and so minimizing it is a good diet strategy for people trying to lean out. But if one is able to eat it in moderation, I'm curious to find any evidence showing that eating an equivalent amount of carbohydrates and calories from fruit instead of sweet potatoes in isocaloric conditions causes the liver changes you mentioned. Thanks in advance for any links you guys have. Really interesting stuff. And then, Rob, you commented... Preston, short answer is yes, it still does affect things, but obviously isocaloric conditions are different from hypercaloric. Therein lies the problem, as fructose tends to alter satiety via several mechanisms, including decreased leptin and increased ghrelin. This paper both discusses and references many of your questions. Chronic exposure is quite different from acute, even under isocaloric conditions. Overweight people, very different from non-obese, which calls into question the whole isocaloric notion in free-living people. How the hell do they pull that off when their appetite controls are malfunctioning? Rodents respond to fructose differently and thus require different dosages to mimic similar metabolic changes. It gets so complex. Wow, that was a mouthful, Rob. First, maybe do some explaining for the layperson what exactly Preston is asking. This is actually a really good question, and then you can kind of talk about your comment a little bit.
Yeah, mainly what he's asking about is just like, you know, for who and at what level does fructose present a problem? And one of the things that I'd mentioned was actually a paper that I forget if Matt tracked it down or Pedro tracked the paper down, but it was basically a paper showing that fructose consumption increases the rate of, back up a little bit more. Fructose can only be processed by the liver in our body. So when we can take it in fructose, it must go through the liver to be either converted into a lipid, or it, you know, ultimately is palmitic acid, or it gets converted into glucose. But the processing that goes on with that tends to promote some not great adaptations in the liver. And one of the problematic adaptations is that the liver upregulates the GLUT4 transport molecule, which is the molecule that pulls in glucose. So normally, the amount of glucose that we would pull into the liver would be somewhat limited, somewhat dependent on like glycogen storage. If we have very depleted glycogen storage, then we would pull more glucose into the liver. But the interesting thing is that fructose tends to upregulate the amount of glucose that gets pulled into the liver. So not only does fructose preferentially fill liver glycogen, it also enhances the ability or the tendency for the liver to further store glycogen from glucose sources. And once you get this, I think the way to look at this is just thinking about like a manufacturing process or something like that. And like if you had some sort of machinery that was full of something, in this case it would be glycogen derived from either fructose or glucose. If that liver, if that machinery gets full of glycogen, we start having problems. Like we start producing fat from any extraneous or any extra carbohydrates, and that process is the beginning of some very, very bad stuff. It is really at the center of the beginning of metabolic derangement, you know, insulin resistance. This is a really important piece, and it's something that I've got to give huge props to Matt on, because this is one of those things, you know, for years, myself and many other people, I think, whether we're talking like Mike Eats or most people in this kind of paleo low-carb camp, we would talk about controlling insulin sensitivity, all that sort of jive, but then you would get hit with some kind of paradoxical situation, say like with a protein like beef that has a very high insulin release. And you know, how do you address that? Like, what's the answer for why beef consumption doesn't really cause metabolic derangement, but carbohydrate consumption, particularly fructose consumption, does cause metabolic derangement? And the ultimate reason for this is a tracking or an understanding of the metabolic pathways that these fuel substrates, the glucose, fructose, and their byproducts, what happens to them, and where does the processing kind of go wrong? And where it goes wrong is when we get too much of it. We get exposed to too much fructose and or too much glucose or some combination of both of those, and then we start developing some problems. And so when we're talking about someone who's obese, these folks already are suffering from what we would call a substrate overload. Like they were overwhelmed with food. They have too much stuff in their system already, so the likelihood for them to respond unfavorably to fructose is that much worse. And Kurt Harris has some good write-ups on this that maybe we can do some linkage to his work as well, but he makes the point that if you are underfed in general, you're hypocaloric, say we're underfeeding you, but the bulk of the calories that you're getting in is coming from fructose, that won't cause all that much of a problem, because although fructose is kind of bad for us, if it's being used as a primary fuel source, we're not going to see the same types of metabolic derangement that we would see with fructose eaten in an isocaloric or a hypercaloric state. So there definitely are some situational considerations, but then if we think a little bit about what we learned from good calories, bad calories, we also see that fructose and carbohydrate consumption in general, but fructose in particular, has some really potent action on leptin and leptin sensitivity, which is one of the main vectors for controlling our satiety, our sense of satisfaction. And that's where like isocaloric or equal calorie but hypocaloric diets, one of them being moderate protein, high fat, one of them being low protein, high carb, if it's the same number of calories, the person eating the low carb approach is typically not particularly hungry, whereas the individual with the high carb, low fat scenario is quite hungry and has a tendency to start converting stored body proteins into glucose because of some hormonal dysregulation. So it's a big problem, and it's good to see that the medical community is starting to wake up to the fructose issue. I talk about this a ton in the book, and again, like Matt's influence on this was huge. So I give him huge props in making me better aware of this whole process, and I think we'll see more and more information on this over the next couple of years.
Yep. All right, cool. Next, we got a question from Steven. Hey, Rob, what is the mechanism that causes fish oil to go rancid, and what effects and symptoms would be seen in someone that has taken fish oil that has gone south? Not going to mention why I might be asking this. Thanks for all that you do.
This is just oxidative damage to the fish oil. Polyunsaturated fats are very reactive to oxygen. Reactive oxygen species in polyunsaturated fats, fats in general, but polyunsaturated fats in particular, are really, really nasty because they lipid peroxides are a chain propagative reaction. One happens and another happens and another happens, and it tends to just keep going. And so it's kind of a bad scenario, and that's why our taste buds be wired into sensing fats that have gone rancid. So like flax oil, fish oil, if it started to oxidize at all, they taste horrible, and for a good reason, because our body really does not want us consuming those. With regards to signs and symptoms, I mean, it's just going to taste horrible, and that's about it. I don't know that you would have very many symptoms outside of that, but then on a health standpoint, you are taking in a massive dose of free radicals, of oxidative potential peroxide-laden fats. So it's not a good gig, which is why we recommend that you keep your fish oil in the refrigerator and keep the lid tight, and you know, buy it from a good source that turns the fish oil in a timely manner, so that it's not just sitting on the shelf for months or years.
Yep. All right. I hate to think about taking rancid fish oil. I might throw up in my mouth right now. Next, we got a question from Jeff. Hey, Rob, I keep hearing you mention that people should be eating lean meats, but from both my own experience with the diet as well as what I've read, it seems to me that we should really be sticking to the fattier cuts as long as everything has good fats, i.e. grass-fed. Is this statement about lean meats made with the presumption that people not have access to good quality meats, or is there some information that I'm missing? If the latter, why do you guys always talk about coconut milk and heavy cream, which is almost entirely fat?
No, Jeff is spot on here. Like, what I'm trying to do is minimize the folks' intake of specifically short chain omega-6 fats. And so if we don't have a grass-fed source of protein, then it's typically going to be pretty heavy of both arachidonic acid and linoleic acid. So it's just a good way to bypass this problem while eating conventional meats, or to kind of diminish the problem. So yeah, Jeff's spot on with this.
Nice. Next, we got a question from Scott L. Hey, Rob and Andy, just wondering if you guys have heard much about transdermal magnesium. I see that NaturalCom has a magnesium gel. Do you know if the absorption is better that way rather than ingestion?
Ah, I'm glad there was a follow-up on this. So we had a question about this maybe two, three months ago, and I emailed NaturalCom and asked them for someone in their technical department to get back to me, and what I would like is a kinetic study indicating that transdermal magnesium was shown to actually, you know, produce increased plasma levels of magnesium. You know, we could easily demonstrate this with regards to an oral supplement. I set up some control standards, get a diagnostic graph chart. You know, I'm using like a HPLC or similar piece of chemistry instrumentation, and then I give people some NaturalCom, you know, like the fizzy drink, and then I blood draw, do like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, and then I could see what the plasma levels of magnesium are. And we should be able to very easily establish a similar type of graph for transdermal magnesium if transdermal magnesium actually goes through the skin. Like, chemically, it doesn't make any sense to me. Something like DMSO, which is a nonpolar solvent, totally makes sense to me that it would go through the skin, because the skin is largely a mass of lipid bilayers and whatnot, and nonpolar items go through the skin relatively easily. Something like an ionic form of magnesium just doesn't make any sense to me at all that it would go through the skin. And I asked them for some validation on this and received no response.
Yeah, so Mike Mahler pushes it.
Yeah, Polkin pushes it. There are some people pushing this stuff. And, you know, I like Natural Calm as a standalone just fine. Like, I like it a bunch. But this transdermal magnesium doesn't make any sense to me. And, you know, and there are people who swear up and down that the transdermal stuff, you know, will just make them, like, pass out and fall asleep. It's great for sleep. Maybe there's some other mechanism going on here that isn't actually dealing with magnesium actually making it through the skin and into the system. But this should be easily validated if this is true. Maybe I'm missing a piece here. Maybe I'm an idiot with the chemistry and I'm missing a piece. But this should be easily validated. And here again, you know, being the jackass that I am, actually want the shit that I recommend to work for people. You know, like, at some point I like Natural Calm enough that I would feel comfortable like having an affiliate thing on my website and like selling some Natural Calm and making some money off of it, because I feel like it legitimately helps people. This transdermal product, though, I couldn't endorse right now. And obviously I'm an idiot, because I could probably make a ton of money off this stuff. But I just, for whatever reason, feel like if I recommend something, it should work, it should benefit people. I should be able to, you know, even on just kind of an anecdotal feedback, like I hear from people, it's like, yeah, this thing seems to work. And with the standard fizzy Natural Calm, I hear that. With the transdermal stuff, I've heard people who sell it give some pretty good endorsements on it, but it doesn't make sense to me chemically at all. So maybe I'll try the Natural Calm folks again. I really like their standard product, but for me to be able to endorse this thing at all, I need some proof that we actually get some transdermal you know, transmission of magnesium. And maybe what I do, I just buy a jar of it and I go to the Chico State chemistry department and I can set up my own standards and just do this myself. And so if these guys don't get back to me, then maybe I'll do that in the future.
Right after the supplement podcast.
Right after the supplement podcast. This would be easier than the supplement podcast. It'd be less work, so.
Oh, okay. This seems complicated to me, Rob, but I'm not a chemist.
Hey, well, you know, but since I fabricated all of my background and it's all pseudoscience, then.
We survived like 3 weeks without a pseudoscience joke. Uh-oh. It's almost time for the zone jokes to come back. Anyway, moving on. We're getting far afield. Follow-up from Ben. Hey, Rob, loving the longer podcast and all the extremely useful info that they convey. Couple questions. This one is actually for Andy. A recent episode. In previous episodes, you have discussed your coconut milk and apple pudding thing that you make as paleo-friendly cheat meal. Do you have a recipe for that? Yeah. So the simplest way to do this is 2 cans of full-fat, i.e. real coconut milk, somewhere between 2 to 4 apples, and a boatload of cinnamon, and I put it in a pan on the stove with the lid, and I cook it for like 25 to 30 minutes because I want to thicken the coconut milk as much as possible. Then I pour it in a blender, puree it, and throw it in the fridge to help it set. I've experimented with a couple different versions based on people's feedback about swapping out some of the coconut milk with coconut oil, which works well to make it a little bit more like a pudding, but the consistency is different. We've played with using strawberries and bananas, and it all works at some level, although I still prefer the original apples, cinnamon, and coconut milk.
Nice.
Any thoughts on that, Rob Wolf?
No, I like it. You know, actually, at the MoveNet gig, Erwan made a couple of smoothies because we were, like, there was a lot of work getting done. And so, like, our afternoon meal was usually pretty light, but we would do coconut milk and fruit smoothie, which was really satisfying and got some calories in quickly. And it was usually, like, you know, whack of coconut milk, maybe a few macadamia nuts just for a little bit of consistency, berries, bananas, you know, kind of whatever was handy, and then blending all that stuff up. And it was delicious. Really, really good.
Yes, even though our friend Kirk Harris would maybe put coconut milk on number three of the preferred human diesel fuel behind butter and heavy cream.
He has it behind that, really.
Yeah, I'll actually say it was actually, you know, one of the things that I was going to mention that Kurt doesn't post in the blog that much when he's really busy, but in the forum, people will post questions and he'll answer. And they're pretty short and to the point, but he's actually, you know, spending more time on the forum than he is actually doing substantive blog posts. Mm-hmm. So I'll send this to you. Actually, it's pretty interesting. But for folks, if you haven't checked out the forum, and you can also search the forum, there's a lot of cool stuff in there that people have asked about and he's given his opinion on, which I think is really interesting.
Nice. That's cool.
Cool. And question two, back to the questions for Rob. I'm eating totally paleo 24/7 and find that I run best when the majority of my calories come from protein sources, almost only meat with the occasional scrambled egg meal mixed in. I eat a small amount of leafy greens at most non-post-workout meals, and I eat between 20 and 40 grams of carbs in the form of yam squash with my post-workout meal, which really should be called my post-workout meat. I eat 16 to 30 ounces of meat in my post-workout refeeds. Is this okay? Basically, I'm wondering if there's any validity to the ammonia concerns in episode 34. I eat 220 plus grams of protein per day, and I am probably causing a considerable amount of gluconeogenesis. Is there any downside to this?
I can't honestly see any real downside to it. Like, if you really wanted to bump up, say, like, athletic performance, then I could maybe make an argument for simply adding in a little bit more carbohydrate. But, you know, the background is that this person's 180 pounds, so he's probably taking in, you know, 1.1, 1.2 grams of protein per pound of body weight, which is good athletic, you know, kind of parameter. With the liver tests, we might see, like, liver enzymes that are slightly elevated from this because of the increased gluconeogenesis, but I just don't see a problem with it. And if you talk to someone like Mike Eads, this is really kind of his preferred method for glycogen repletion, is allowing the liver to largely deal with this, both from the perspective of converting the glycerol backbone of triglycerides and fats, converting that into glucose, and then also doing whatever gluconeogenesis we need to do out of protein. And all of this stuff ends up working kind of without much of a vector from insulin. So it makes sense in a lot of ways. Like, there could be some ways of tweaking this to improve performance, but, like, if you look down at the performance parameters for this guy, it's pretty damn good. I mean, it's looking good. So yeah. I would say Full steam ahead. Like, if you want to tinker with, say, like, in the summer months, doing a little bit more carbohydrate, a little bit less protein, that could be one thing to just kind of cycle and play with. But I definitely feel better at that higher protein intake, more fat intake, really just kind of punctuated carbs post workout, like after jiu-jitsu or something like that. It's definitely good.
Yep. Good question. All right, next one is a bit of a doozy, Rob. Are you ready?
I'll do my best.
Question from Ravi. Rob and Andy, love the podcast and the blog. You guys are awesome. I look forward to the podcast every week. Thanks for putting all this information out on the internet. Question about IF and calorie restriction. My question is there a problem with doing intermittent fasting alongside a period of severe calorie restriction? I've been playing around with IF for about 2 months now. Per your recommendations, I'm eating strict gluten-free, dairy-free paleo diet and supplementing with natural calm and fish oil. Training is 3 times a week, linear progression strength, some high-intensity interval training, and scaled CrossFit WODs, and some LSD on the on the weekends.
Life is That's always the time for it.
Life is stress-free for me. Graduated college in May and don't start work until July. Sleep is 9 to 10 hours a night. Going from an unweighed, unmeasured paleo approach, generally less than 15 calories per pound of body weight, to a zone with deleted carb blocks a la 42 ways to skin the zone. I want to make leaning out a priority. Should I drop the IF 16-hour fast per recommendations from Lean Gains when doing the zone? Everything I've read highlights intermittent fasting as an alternative to caloric restriction. So not sure if doing them together is a problem. Loved IF when I was unweighed and unmeasured and eating closer to 15 calories per pound of body weight, but not sure I should keep it in the mix. Thanks.
I don't see a problem with keeping them in the mix. I mean, you just keep an eye on how you're looking, how you're feeling, how you're performing. If the main focus is leaning out, that's probably fine. You definitely get some enhanced insulin sensitivity out of intermittent fasting. And then if you're doing some graded but not overly severe caloric restriction, then and then the way he's doing the tweaked zone there, low glycemic load, low insulin load, calorie restriction should lean out quickly, shouldn't have a problem with losing muscle mass. I don't see too much of a problem with it, unless, you know, you're just feeling completely knackered from this, and you know, you have some specific performance issues or goals that are getting overly impacted from this. But this is one of those things too that with a significant amount of leaning out, we can kind of expect some performance decrease, you know, unless you're just taking a very slow trajectory to the whole process. But a more aggressive approach like this, your life will not feel spectacular for a period of time. Then you would kind of ramp calories up to a maintenance and just kind of keep the intermittent fasting in the mix.
Yep. All right. Next, got a question from Jerry. Hey, Rob, thanks for asking my question about gum bleeding. I'm still working through what might be the cause of my glucose insulin weirdness, and I've been pretty strict, low-carb, no-dairy paleo for about 4 months. I recently went on tour with my band. I waved at Chico when we drove past, and I managed to stay paleo, save for a couple tacos here and there. Can't do the West Coast without eating tacos.
Seriously.
I went so far as to eat canned wild salmon with avocado and onions in the van when I couldn't make a real meal or find anything appropriate in a restaurant. I kept my drinking to one or two glasses of whiskey or wine at each show, even though PBRs were doled out like bottled water. My strictness on my diet by default entailed some fasting and a lower caloric intake, and I felt like a caveman moving heavy equipment every night. I felt great. I leaned out without losing muscle. I felt stronger. No brain fog, even after a long drive, and I even noticed that my feet didn't get stinky, despite not changing my socks for a few days at a time. I swear this is true. Maybe the result of not drinking beer. Anyway, I'm totally sold on the paleo thing, particularly the gluten issue, but the past few days I've been tracking my blood sugar with my dad's glucose meter. He's a type 2. My blood glucose has been hovering around the mid-90s to low 100s. Immediately after a fruit-heavy meal, it even spiked up to 130. Should I be worried how accurate are home glucose meters? I generally eat very low carb, and I've been eating some fruit since they're starting to be in season, and it's retarded hot in Baltimore. Could too much protein be an issue, or perhaps an uptick in caloric intake since coming home? Could coffee? I drink about 2 cups a day. I've cut way down on booze since starting paleo, but I still have about a glass or two of wine or bourbon every day. Could that be an issue, even if theoretically that much booze should lower blood sugar? Is it weird that I would see all the other benefits from paleo but still have blood glucose in the high normal range? I also take spoonfuls of apple cider vinegar after every meal. I use a lot of cinnamon, turmeric, and cumin in my cooking. Sorry for the really long comment. Just want to cover all the bases and let you know that there are metalheads amongst your 6 listeners. Thank you.
Nice. Right on. You know, the home glucose meters typically are pretty accurate. This could just be an outgrowth of more, a little more fruit intake. Like, this is just some stuff you would have to tinker with. Those numbers aren't, like, super concerning. Like, if A1Cs were real high, I might be a little bit concerned about that. But it sounds like you're all over the place. There's a lot of travel. There's probably some dodgy sleep. But you're managing all of this really, really well. And I suspect if it was an even more mellow kind of environment for you, that we might see some decreased blood sugar levels. So, I mean, all things considered, I'm not super worried by all that. You know, like body fat's going down, strength and muscle mass are maintaining and all that, I wouldn't be too worried about this, especially given that you know it could be a really unhealthy, very, very challenging environment. It sounds like it's being navigated really well.
Cool. All right. And Rob, this is the final question. We are smoking through these questions.
Ding, 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 ding. Winna, winna, chicken dinner.
Question from Justin. Hey, Rob. Different Justin that has written questions in the past. I've been following the site and podcast for more than a year and sincerely wanted to thank you for all that you guys do. Many more people than are vocal are seeing benefit from your work. A while back, I remember reading your 42 Ways to Skin the Zone article and coming across the phrase mitochondrial redux. I take this to mean reductive oxidation, but was wondering if you could expand on what this phenomenon is and why it matters for someone that would be a hard gainer. All of the references I could find to it in searches online were opaque at best, and definitely not in the context of training, mostly dealing with geriatrics or medical patients. Thanks again.
So what this was mainly talking about is just kind of trying to optimize the metabolic flow, the energy flow into our systems. And what we find for sure is that carbohydrate consumption versus fat or metabolism, it goes through a different metabolic pathway in the mitochondria than fat does. And there are some reactive oxygen species that are generated from carbohydrate metabolism. It happens much more frequently at a much higher rate than it does with fat metabolism. So this is the main point of dealing with that. And then there's also some of this, and I don't know if I mentioned this specifically in that article, but when we get into any type of a fasting, intermittent fasting, caloric restriction, ketosis kind of scenario, there appears to be some cellular autophagy. Basically, the cells get into a stress response, and part of that stress response is to actually chew up and degrade and use broken down constituents in the cell for energy. So this has dual benefit. One of them is that it kind of props up some of our caloric load, at least for a period of time, and it's being propped up by bits and pieces of cellular floatsome that would otherwise just accumulate in our cells and potentially cause a problem down the road. There's this stuff, lipofuscin, which is an incompletely metabolized fat sources that gets removed out of cells. And so there's a couple of different angles with this that, you know, the shifting towards the way that we're trying to eat, trying to manage our lifestyle ends up helping with regards to the mitochondrial redox.
Good question. Rob Wolf, you're done.
Holy cats.
Someone out there has to take a shot.
Did we explain to anybody what this is?
No, I didn't.
Do you want to tell people? I know you're embarrassed. I think it's kind of funny.
Well, I think you should then just give a quick,
You received the email first, though, not me.
Yes. So our friend Leni Hoffman emailed us to basically say that she was proposing a podcast drinking game where that you would listen to the podcast, and every time a Rob Wolfism was said, like holy cats or a zone joke, or I think I spun Rob out or something, was said, you had to take a shot of tequila. And let's see. Rob Wolf drinking game. Every time he says, holy cats, white buffalo in the sky, or you talk about caffeine, everyone has to drink. So I think that's a genius idea. But if anyone actually is socially sitting around listening to the podcast and drinking, I have some concerns about where we're headed as a society.
We probably would need to prop up their social circles a little bit if that's where it's gone to. But if the Paleo Solution drinking game becomes a hit, then, you know, there's some good from that too. So
absolutely, Rob. And then we can have a blog post, so we can get like cards, and it can be the whole thing. It can be like Dungeons and Dragons.
oh dear.
All right, Rob, well, I'm going to let you get back to work because we are done. Episode 40. You are halfway to 80 right now. This is a big
a big day, because when we get to 100, all the six listener jokes are banned.
They will never be banned. Like, it, the tagline for the show on the new website is, six listeners can't be wrong.
Gosh. And once it's out on the internet, it'll never be put back in its cage.
It's like pee in a pool, baby. Yep.
All right, man. Well, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Andy. Talk to you soon.
All right. See you, man.
Bye.